You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, June 21st, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear today rise from the voices of our hosts and guests alone. They are shaped by their experiences, their convictions, and their search for truth. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. What you hear in this space is unfiltered. What you hear in this space is honest. What you hear in this space belongs to the people who speak it. And now, with that clarity set before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is not a place where truth whispers. It does not slip in quietly or wait for permission to speak. Here, truth steps forward with its full weight, steady and unafraid, refusing to hide in the shadows. Urgency is not a passing feeling in this space. It is the heartbeat beneath every story we tell. Clarity is not optional. It is the responsibility we carry each time we open this microphone. And while our heart remains rooted in Palestine, in the West Bank, in Gaza, our vision stretches far beyond the borders drawn on any map. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at checkpoints or coastlines. They move across continents, across capitals, across the quiet rooms where decisions are made far from the people who must live with their consequences. Wherever you are listening from, whether guiding your car through the long hours of the night, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not smooth the edges of reality. We do not soften the truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not reshape the story to comfort those who prefer silence. This is a place where truth stands unfiltered, where resistance is not an idea, but a daily act of survival, where solidarity is not a slogan, but a legacy carried forward through generations. The voices rising from occupied land remain unwavering. They rise beside movements across the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never isolated. It is connected, intertwined, woven through the lives of people who refuse to surrender their humanity. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, tying devastation to determination, tying grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the ember of defiance survives. Even when the world turns away, that ember refuses to fade. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It crosses borders. And it remains sacred. Today, we witness a moment that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. A moment when the man Israel once called its greatest ally stands on a stage and humiliates the Israeli prime minister. A moment when Donald Trump looks Benjamin Netanyahu in the eye and says, in essence, "You are nothing without me. You cannot survive without me. Your country cannot stand without my return." This is not a political jab. This is a declaration that exposes the deepest crisis Israel has faced since its creation. And today, we break it down. Trump's words were not accidental. They were not off the cuff. They were calculated. He said Netanyahu betrayed him. He said Netanyahu failed him. He said Netanyahu begged him for help. And then he said the sentence that shook the Israeli establishment. Israel will not be able to survive if I am not in the White House. For a former American president to say this publicly is unprecedented. It is a political earthquake. It is a humiliation broadcast to the world. And Netanyahu could not respond. Because Trump was not just attacking a man, he was attacking the myth of Israeli strength. For decades, Netanyahu sold himself as the protector of Israel, the strongman, the strategist, the irreplaceable leader. He built his career on fear. Fear of Iran, fear of Palestinians, fear of Arabs, fear of the world. He told Israelis, "Only I can protect you. Only I can manage America. Only I can keep Israel safe." And then Trump shattered that illusion in one sentence. Trump's message was clear. Israel is not a partner. Israel is not an ally. Israel is a dependent. A dependent that needs Trump to survive. A dependent that cannot stand on its own. A dependent that must obey. This is not support. This is ownership. And for the first time, the world saw the relationship for what it truly is. Not a friendship, but a hierarchy. Inside Israel, panic spread. Politicians were stunned. Journalists were speechless. Military analysts were alarmed. Because Trump did not just insult Netanyahu, he exposed Israel's greatest fear. That without American protection, Israel is vulnerable. That without American weapons, Israel is limited. That without American political cover, Israel is isolated. Trump said the quiet part out loud. Israel today is not the Israel of the past. It is divided. It is unstable. It is losing global support. It is facing resistance on multiple fronts. It is drowning in political chaos. Netanyahu's government is collapsing from within. The military is overstretched. The economy is weakening. The settlers are out of control. The world is turning away. Trump's humiliation did not create the crisis. It revealed it. So here, listen to this part. While Israel struggles, the region is changing. Iran is rising. Turkey is recalibrating. Saudi Arabia is repositioning. The UAE is hedging. Qatar is mediating. Egypt is stabilizing. Lebanon is resisting. Yemen is disrupting global trade. And the United States is distracted. Israel is no longer the center of the Middle East. It is a player in a game it no longer controls. Okay, look at this. For Palestinians, Trump's statement is not surprising. It is confirmation. Confirmation that Israel's power is not organic. Confirmation that Israel's survival depends on foreign protection. Confirmation that the occupation is not sustainable. Confirmation that the myth of invincibility is collapsing. Palestinians have always known the truth. A state built on dispossession cannot last forever. A state built on apartheid cannot survive indefinitely. A state built on fear cannot maintain control. Trump simply said what history has been whispering. So here is what you, my dear listener, needs to understand. Here is what you need to give attention to. Netanyahu is not just a politician. He is a symbol. A symbol of arrogance, a symbol of manipulation, a symbol of endless war. A symbol of a project built on domination. And now, he is a symbol of collapse. Trump's humiliation marks the beginning of the end. Ha! Not just for Netanyahu, but for the political model he created. A model based on fear. A model based on division. A model based on American dependency. That model is dying. So, okay, now what comes next? A fractured society. A weakened military, a collapsing political system, a declining economy, a loss of global legitimacy, a growing resistance, a shifting region. Israel is entering a new phase,
a phase of uncertainty, a phase of vulnerability, a phase of reckoning. Trump's words were not prophecy. They were diagnosis.
So today we stand at a crossroads. The United States is no longer united behind Israel. Israel is no longer united behind Netanyahu. The region is no longer shaped by American power. The world is no longer silent about Palestinian suffering. The myth is cracking. The narrative is collapsing. The truth is emerging. And Trump, intentionally or not, accelerated the process. Today, we witnessed a moment of political humiliation that revealed a deeper truth. A truth about power. A truth about dependency. A truth about a state built on fear and sustained by foreign protection. Trump humiliated Netanyahu. But in doing so, he exposed Israel's greatest weakness. This is not the Middle East of yesterday. This is the Middle East of today. I am Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine. And today, we realized the mask fall. Okay, now let us turn to the chapter no one wants to confront, but everyone feels in their bones. Netanyahu's game. A game so reckless, so corrosive, so soaked in self-preservation that it has set an entire region on fire. Because when a leader fears prison more than he fears war, the world becomes his battlefield. Look closely at the pattern. Every escalation, every strike, every provocation carries the same shadow behind it. A man fighting not for his country, not for security, not for strategy, but for his own survival. The endless war in Gaza, the push toward confrontation with Iran, the widening conflict in Lebanon, the destabilization of the Gulf, the political chaos exported across borders. All of it, according to critics, tied to one man's desperate attempt to outrun accountability. And the cost? Over 200,000 Palestinian lives lost, and over 2 million lives shattered while the world watches. Entire neighborhoods erased, families buried under rubble, children growing up without parents, without homes, without a future that feels safe. And for what? For a political calculation? For a courtroom delay? For a man and his inner circle to buy time?
Some say Netanyahu is playing for survival. Others say he is playing for legacy. But the truth many Palestinians feel is far simpler and far darker. He is playing with human lives as if they are bargaining chips. The war in Gaza becomes a shield. The tension with Iran becomes a distraction. The fire in Lebanon becomes a smokescreen. Every front becomes a stage where he can shout, "Not now! I am defending the nation!" while quietly avoiding the courtroom door. And Sarah stands beside him, just as invested in the outcome, just as determined to keep the walls from closing in. So we must ask the question that sits heavy in the air. What kind of man gambles with the fate of millions to save himself? What kind of man fuels war after war, knowing the cost will be paid by children who never chose this life? What kind of man watches a region collapse and still whispers, "Just a little longer, just until I am safe"? Is that a human? Is that humanity? Or is that something far more sinister? Because when a man is willing to risk the entire Middle East to avoid a prison cell, when he is willing to sacrifice lives, stability, and the future of an entire people, the line between human and monster begins to blur. And the world must decide whether it will keep pretending not to see it. This is the reality we confront today. A region trembling under the weight of one man's fear. A people paying the price for a leader's desperation. A world watching, calculating, hesitating. And the question remains, how long? How long can a nation, a region, or a world endure the ambitions of a man who fears justice more than he fears war? This is This Week in Palestine, where we speak the truths others bury, where we name the patterns others ignore, where we refuse to look away.
Today, we confront a truth that is as dangerous as it is undeniable. A truth that the region feels in every border clash, every airstrike, every political crisis. A truth that one man, Benjamin Netanyahu, is willing to ignite the Middle East to save himself. This is not strategy. This is not national security. This is survival, personal survival, at any cost. And today, we break down the dirty game Netanyahu is playing, the way he is dragging Donald Trump into it, and how the entire region is paying the price. Netanyahu is not governing from a position of strength. He is governing from fear. He faces corruption charges. He faces mass protests. He faces rebellion inside the army. He faces a collapsing economy. He faces a public that no longer believes him. And he faces the one thing he cannot negotiate with: the possibility of prison. For Netanyahu, this is not politics. This is survival. When leaders are cornered, they choose one of two paths: step down or burn everything around them. Netanyahu chose the second. His escape plan is simple: create chaos, escalate conflict, provoke enemies, drag allies into confrontation, make himself indispensable. If the region is burning, he can say, "You cannot remove me now. You cannot prosecute me now. You cannot replace me now." Chaos becomes his shield. Netanyahu knows Trump is his best chance at political survival. Trump offers protection. Trump offers political cover. Trump offers unconditional support. But Trump also demands loyalty, and Netanyahu is desperate enough to give it. The real argument? That Netanyahu is trying to pull Trump into a regional escalation. Not for Israel's security, but for his own. If Trump returns to power, Netanyahu believes he can avoid prison. If Trump stays politically relevant, Netanyahu believes he can survive. So he feeds Trump crisis. He feeds him fear. He feeds him the illusion that only Trump can save Israel. It is manipulation disguised as alliance. Netanyahu's actions are not random. They follow a pattern. A pattern of escalation. Lebanon, he intensifies strikes. He provokes Hezbollah. He pushes the northern front toward war. Gaza, he maintains siege. He maintains killing. He blocks reconstruction. He fuels desperation. West Bank, he empowers settlers. He expands raids. He destabilizes Palestinian cities. Iran, he pushes for confrontation. He pressures the U.S. to act. He frames every move as existential. This is not defense. This is ignition. Inside Israel, the cracks are widening. The military is exhausted. The economy is weakening. The settlers are out of control. The judiciary is under attack. The public is divided. Netanyahu's government is held together by fear and fanaticism. He knows that if he loses power, he loses everything. So he clings to power with both hands, even if the country falls apart beneath him. The United States is not blind to Netanyahu's game, but Washington is divided. Some see Netanyahu as a liability. Others see him as a partner. Trump sees him as a tool. Netanyahu sees Trump as salvation. The video argues that Netanyahu is trying to force America's hand, to make the U.S. choose escalation over diplomacy, confrontation over restraint. If the U.S. is dragged into conflict, Netanyahu becomes untouchable. This is the dirty game. Okay, so here is how his Netanyahu's survival strategy has consequences far beyond Israel. Lebanon, a single miscalculation could trigger a full war. Syria, airstrikes risk retaliation. Iraq, militias respond to U.S. involvement. Yemen, Red Sea tensions escalate. Iran, any provocation risks regional conflict. Netanyahu is playing with fire, but it is the region that burns. For Palestinians, Netanyahu's game is not new. It is the same strategy he has used for decades. Escalate, distract, divide, blame, repeat. But today, the stakes are higher. The region is shifting. The world is watching. The myth of Israeli invincibility is cracking. Netanyahu's desperation exposes the fragility of the entire system. Today,
Today, we exposed a strategy built on fear, manipulation, and desperation. A strategy that risks the region for the sake of one man's freedom. A strategy that drags allies into conflict and pushes enemies toward retaliation. A strategy that reveals the moral collapse of a political project built on domination. Netanyahu is playing a dirty game, but the region is refusing to play along. I am Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine. And for the meantime, we watch the truth unfold. So, okay, now let's ask this question. Why does Israel keep attacking Lebanon today, even though every peace initiative, every ceasefire proposal, every diplomatic roadmap clearly states that stopping the attacks on Lebanon is a basic requirement for stability? Why does Israel insist on striking villages, fields, infrastructure, and border towns, even when the world is telling it to stop? To answer that question, we need to understand something deeper. Israel is not acting from strength. Israel is acting from fear, fragmentation, and political desperation. And for now, the battlefield in Lebanon has become the place where all of Israel's internal crises explode outward. Israel's political system is collapsing from within. Its leadership is fractured. Its military is overstretched. Its society is divided. Its economy is shaking. In moments like this, Israel historically does one thing. Exports its crisis outward. Lebanon becomes the pressure valve. Lebanon becomes the distraction. Lebanon becomes the stage where Israeli leaders try to prove they are still in control. But the truth is the opposite. The more Israel attacks Lebanon, the more it reveals how little control it actually has. Here is the bigger picture. Israel is not just defying the region, it is defying Trump himself. Trump wants calm. Trump wants a controlled Middle East. Trump wants a stage where he can negotiate, posture, and claim victory. But Israel today is not listening. It is acting unilaterally, aggressively, and recklessly. Why? Because Israeli leaders believe that escalation in Lebanon strengthens their political survival at home. They believe that if the North is burning, no one will talk about corruption trials. No one will talk about protests. No one will talk about economic collapse. Lebanon becomes the shield. Israel knows something it will never admit publicly. The Northern Front is the one front it cannot control. Hezbollah's capabilities have grown. Its precision weapons have multiplied. Its intelligence networks are deep. Its deterrence is real. Every Israeli strike on Lebanon is not a show of power. It is a sign of panic, a sign that Israel is trying to prevent a reality it cannot face, that the balance of power on the northern border has shifted, and shifted permanently. Inside Israel, the political system is in chaos. The government is unstable. The opposition is fragmented. The military is exhausted. The settlers are out of control. The public is losing trust. When a state is this fragile, leaders often choose escalation over accountability. Lebanon becomes the distraction. Lebanon becomes the excuse. Lebanon becomes the battlefield where Israeli leaders try to prove they are still relevant. But the more they escalate, the more they expose their weakness. For the meantime, the region is changing faster than Israel can adapt. Iran is rising. Turkey is recalibrating. Saudi Arabia is repositioning. The Gulf is diversifying. The United States is distracted. Russia and China are expanding influence. Israel is no longer the center of the regional equation. It is a player in a game it no longer controls. So it attacks Lebanon to remind the world it still has teeth. But the world sees something else, a state lashing out because it is losing its grip. While Israel plays politics,
Lebanon pays the price. Villages burned, fields destroyed, families displaced, homes shattered, lives interrupted. The strikes do not weaken Hezbollah. They do not change the balance of power. They do not bring security. They only deepen suffering. They only widen the wound. They only push Lebanon closer to collapse. And Israel knows this. But for now, it continues. Because the attacks are not about strategy. They are about survival. Political survival.
Every Israeli strike on Lebanon is also a message to Palestinians, a message that Israel will escalate anywhere, anytime, without restraint, a message that Israel is willing to burn the region to maintain dominance, a message that Israel's crisis will be paid for by others. But Palestinians have seen this pattern for decades, and they know something Israel refuses to accept. A state built on occupation cannot find security through aggression. A state built on fear cannot find stability through fire. A state built on domination cannot survive without enemies. Lebanon becomes the mirror reflecting Israel's own instability. So why does Israel keep attacking Lebanon today, even though peace requires stopping? Because Israel is not seeking peace. It is seeking time. Time to survive politically. Time to delay accountability. Time to manage internal collapse. Time to avoid confronting the truth. Lebanon is not the target. Lebanon is the tool. A tool used by Israeli leaders to escape their own crises. Today, we saw a region on edge, a border on fire, and a political system collapsing under its own weight. Israel attacks Lebanon not because it is strong, but because it is weak. Not because it seeks peace, but because it fears accountability. Not because it was attacked, but because it wants to reignite the war with Iran. Not because it controls the region, but because the region is slipping away. This is not the Middle East of yesterday. This is the Middle East of today. I am Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine. And for the meantime, we watch the truth unfold. So now, in real time, we are watching something extraordinary unfold, something no one expected, something that tells us more about power, loyalty, and corruption than any headline ever could. We are watching Donald Trump's biggest donors turn against him. Not quietly, not gradually, but all at once, like a dam cracking under pressure. And yes, that includes Miriam Adelson. The Adelson Empire, once the financial spine of Trump's political machine, is now stepping back, recalculating, repositioning. A week ago, these same donors were standing shoulder to shoulder with him. A week ago, every influencer in the MAGA universe was singing his praises. A week ago, members of Congress were lining up to defend him. A week ago, AIPAC was treating them like their golden child. A week ago, Israeli media was framing him as the indispensable ally. But today, the tone has changed. Today, the knives are out. Today, the same people who once crowned him are sharpening their blades. And why? Because he dared to strike a deal with Iran to stop the war. Because he dared to step outside the script written for him by the lobbyists, the donors, the foreign interests, and the political machines that have shaped U.S. policy for decades. Let me be clear. I am not taking Trump's side. We all know he can flip on his own words faster than a page turning in the wind. We all know consistency is not his strength. But truth is truth, and truth must be spoken. He is now facing the worst political storm of his life. Not because of Democrats, not because of the media, not because of the legal system, but because he crossed the people who believed they owned him. He is now seeing who his real enemies are. He is now realizing that loyalty in Washington is a rented commodity. He is now discovering that the same hands that lift you up can drop you without warning. And the pressure is only beginning. So now, because now, according to critics, he will be confronted with the Epstein files. Now he will be confronted with the donors who feel betrayed. Now he will be confronted with the political machine that once protected him and is now preparing to punish him. And at the center of that machine stands his old ally, his old partner, his old political shadow, Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu, who has mastered the art of survival. Netanyahu, who has outlived coalitions, scandals, indictments, and international outrage. Netanyahu, who knows how to turn allies into shields and enemies into distractions. Netanyahu, who will not hesitate to throw Trump under the bus if it buys him one more day of political oxygen. So here we are, watching a man who thought he controlled the game suddenly realize he was only a piece on the board. And this is where we must be honest with ourselves. We do not stand with Trump. We do not defend Trump. But we must stand against the forces that are now turning on him. Because those forces are the same ones that have silenced voices, shaped wars, manipulated policy, and punished anyone who dared to question Israel's actions. So, okay, you see where I'm heading? We must stand against corruption. We must stand against the lobbyists who believe they own American foreign policy. We must stand against AIPAC, whose primary mission is to silence anyone who speaks a word of truth about Israel. We must stand against the Israeli lobby that has influenced elections, pressured lawmakers, and shaped narratives for decades. This is not about Trump. This is about the system that believes it can crush anyone who steps out of line. This is about the machinery of influence that operates behind closed doors. This is about the price paid by Palestinians, by Americans, by the entire region, when policy is written not by conscience, but by pressure. And now, together, let us turn to a voice that refuses to be intimidated. Let us listen to Wally Rashid exposing the AIPAC lobby, a moment where the mask slips and the machinery of influence is laid bare. In this segment, Senator Chris Van Hollen speaks with a clarity Washington rarely allows. He names what so many fear to say out loud, that the Israel lobby must be challenged, questioned, and rejected. This is not just commentary. This is a window into the pressure, the power, and the politics shaping U.S. policy on Israel. A window into the forces that have shaped war, shaped silence, shaped the suffering of millions. And now, together, let us listen.
The Israel lobby group AIPAC is going after Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland because he was interviewed stating that nobody should be taking money from AIPAC. So take a listen to this clip here and then let's talk about it.
Should Democrats refuse to take money from AIPAC writ large?
The answer is yes, because what AIPAC demands of candidates it supports is unconditional support for the actions of the government of Israel, regardless of what those actions are. You know, we don't do that for any other country in the world, meaning we, the United States government.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I mean, I also don't take money from big oil companies or, you know, a lot of other special interests. But I do believe that when it comes to AIPAC, that people should not take AIPAC contributions again, because their position is you've got to support the actions of the government of Israel, no matter what.
Should Demer?
So I think this is just, you know, it doesn't sound like anything controversial. I mean, aside to AIPAC, it doesn't sound like anything controversial to the average person. AIPAC then quotes that and says, those aren't our positions, and there's no such thing as unconditional aid to Israel. Yes, it is. It's basically America's actions for the last several decades. Van Hollen doesn't get support from our members because our members don't support senators who lie about them and obsessively focus on undermining a partnership that benefits America. Van Hollen doesn't get support from your members because he doesn't want it. So there was a context added. There's a community note to AIPAC's quote, and it says AIPAC has repeatedly attacked anyone seeking to condition aid to Israel. For example, Congress must reject any attempts to block or condition aid or weapons to Israel. Conditioning aid to Israel would be irresponsible and outrageous and a gigantic mistake. Israel's offensive weaponry, they posted this in 2024, enable this defensive victory. America must ensure our democratic ally has the offensive and defensive resources it needs to protect its families. Congress must reject any attempt to block or condition aid or weapons to Israel. They stated exactly that. I mean, they're just stating exactly the exact same thing they just stated they don't do. It would be outrageous or a gigantic mistake to condition or leverage aid. That's what AIPAC is all about. That's what AIPAC is all about. Track AIPAC said, quoted that jokingly, saying there's no such thing as unconditional aid to Israel. So Chris Van Hollen, he shifted a lot on his stance when it came to Israel-Palestine. And honestly, I'll give him credit for that shift, at least. If you look at his voting record, it says plus 14 pro-Israel points. If you look at his voting record, he totally turned after October 7th when it came to Israel. Look at this right here is his voting record. You'll see he's been in office for a long time, from 2005 all the way up until 2023, then totally shifted on all of his votes. And then if you go to his co-sponsored bills, again, same exact thing from 2004 all the way through, and then immediately he shifted. This should actually be pro-Palestine too. And then immediately shifted completely. He has met two of my friends, one of them Adnan. He was on the flotilla heading to Gaza. I think the photo is somewhere on X. It has to be. And Chris Van Hollen met with my friend from the flotilla in Gaza. He met with both of them. He listened to them. There was only one senator so far that I saw, which is Chris Van Hollen, who actually spoke out about the Palestinian American who was abducted by Israel while she was in Jerusalem. Chris Van Hollen, again, only senator who actually spoke out about it. So he's been doing a lot of things recently to show that he's shifted on his stance. It's very obvious. He'll take a lot of input. If you message him before, I've talked to somebody who's messaged or emailed his office and they actually got a response back related to a policy issue on Israel he's had. So you could tell that there has been a shift there. He also wrote this article in the New York Times, which I really liked. He wrote it back in May, and he stated the hard truth my party needs to face. And it's a New York Times opinion piece. At the time, this garnered a lot of criticism by, of course, the same people, the Israeli lobby. And it says, Democrats need to face a hard truth. While Republicans' approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has failed, so has ours. The Democratic Party has provided reflexive and unconditional support to Israeli governments, even as their actions increasingly undermined American interests and values. For decades, we have called for a two-state solution, but we failed to use our leverage to make it real. It's past time that we use that leverage to end the occupation and achieve two states with full political and legal rights for all. That means withdrawing taxpayer support from Israel and conditioning arms sales. More of my colleagues are realizing the status quo is unacceptable. 40 Democrats recently voted to block the transfer of certain military equipment to Netanyahu's government, compared with only 15 of us in April of last year. So there has been a shift in that stance. To be clear, I support Israel's needs for security, but far too long, most Democrats have unquestionably accepted Israel's arguments that American weapons are needed to and used solely for its defense. We have not yet fully confronted the fact that Israel has used its strength not only as a shield, but also as a sword to bury the two-state solution and advance the far right's vision of greater Israel. So, I mean, I'm impressed with the article. There are some words where I'm like, okay, you didn't really need to say that. I feel like one thing that I was like, okay, he could have went further. But then again, it is the New York Times and he's trying to appeal to average people. When he mentions what are the outcomes if you don't accept a two-state solution, I'll read to you his outcomes, because he listed everything except for one outcome, which I was like, okay, you could have listed the truth there. And he stated, where is it? Both Republicans and Democratic administrations are responsible for where we are today. Trump, he moved to the embassy to Jerusalem, implicitly condoned settlements and closed the Palestinian mission in Washington and our consulate in East Jerusalem. It was crazy that Trump, I mean, not crazy, but the fact that Trump did that just goes to show how much the shift has already happened. We cannot accept the status quo. Democrats can and should be both pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian. To support both, Democrats must move forward with a plan that beyond the failures of the past and towards durable peace. So you could definitely tell he's trying to appeal there. If the United States fails to consider the other options to secure equal and political rights for all, if a two-state solution fails, the alternatives, either a permanent apartheid state or the expulsion of Palestinians, should be abhorrent and unacceptable to everyone. That's the part where I was like, okay, those are two true things in that, yes, those are the things that would happen. There's one more, though, that wasn't listed, and I think it wasn't listed because it would have been too controversial, which goes to show how is the expulsion of Palestinians more controversial than stating the dismantling of Israel and a one-state solution between the river and sea for all. That could have been the third he lists. He didn't list that. I would say he should have, but whatever. In general, I mean, nobody else has written in this an article like this within his party, within his position of power. So I'd say that's already a good shift in that direction. Moving forward will not be easy. We'll place the United States on a collision course with any Israeli government opposed to a Palestinian state. All of them. It will face strong resistance from many here and at home, including the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which has opposed any efforts to condition support for Israel. AIPAC's influence in Congress remains formidable, even as Americans increasingly reject its positions and use its use of super PACs to pour money into elections. Democrats must stand firm. So here's the thing that I'll have to that I have to say about this. The issue with this is it's too partisan. And that's why right now I've told you guys a lot about the things that I do. Like, a lot of the efforts that I do is trying to focus on making it bipartisan. There was Thomas Massey. There was Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're gone now. It's very difficult, and it's not even fully partisan right now, because even within the Democrat side, there will never be any sort of policies or bills that actually advance in regards to a two-state solution, because you at least need one party in power to fully push it. The thing is, even if Democrats had full power right now, they still wouldn't push it, because only half of their party would support it. And that's not even considering the Republican side, who wouldn't even support it at all, even though many conservatives do support it. But the establishment has done a really good job rooting every single one of those out. So there has to be a way to shift that on both sides. On the Republican side, unfortunately, there's not one person, correct me if I'm wrong, I've looked at the candidates, I've had you guys message me before and comment on candidates on the Republican side that I should look into. There are no Republican candidates that are currently showing in the polls and have a very, very, very strong chance of winning, or have the same amount of money to fight in the race as the other opponent. That is just simply the case now. It doesn't mean I won't support them, but there's no candidate that actually has a really strong chance of winning that has the same amount of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars of backing, however much they need in that specific race. So right now, there isn't somebody who's actually fighting on that side. That's not good. There has to be a way to shift that. Now, we could focus on shifting that, but at this current moment, it's too late in regards to the primaries. Those candidates are already kind of put in place. And AIPAC did what it wanted there. AIPAC knew that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey were a massive threat, because they knew, okay, we're already losing the Democrats. What are we going to do about the Republicans? We have to make sure that we gut out anybody that's even an inkling of has even an inkling of criticism for Israel, anybody. That was their plan, because they recognize they at least can't lose both sides. Lauren Boebert, she's always supported voting for Israel. There have only been two fiscal bills sending money overseas that she didn't support to Israel. She's never made any statement prior to that. Her entire record is in support of Israel. She definitely will never support Palestine. Even just a couple fiscal bills she didn't want to send money overseas, it set off the Israel lobby. They went after her because of that. They also went after her because she supported Thomas Massey and she was campaigning for him. They'll go after anybody that even deviates slightly from the norm. So if that's the case, where do we go from here? Ultimately, what's going to happen is there's just going to simply be more distancing between the United States. It's just going to be isolated as a pariah, because how much longer can this go until U.S. policy is completely deviated from policy all across the rest of the planet? That's already where we're heading. Israel is not is not only a big threat to the entire planet, but it's also isolating America. It's just isolating us from the rest of the world. It's not good when the entire planet starts going in one direction and America goes in a different direction, because this tiny project in the Middle East is shoving our foreign policy in a direction we shouldn't be going in. So that's just kind of how things are in that regard. And there's just other stuff. Democrats deliver account. They stated Senator Chris Van Hollen on rejecting AIPAC funds. And it's just the exact same thing that I just previously stated. So a lot of news articles are kind of picking up this story. You support for a government that willingly lies about Palestinians' indignity to cover up their crimes. And there's just a lot of quotes here just kind of commenting on the whole thing.
And now, before we close, I bring you something that speaks for itself. A moment captured by WLA Times featuring Israel's representative Danny Dannon, a man whose every appearance at the United Nations has become a study in denial, deflection, and desperation. But this time, the world did not bend. This time, the room did not nod politely. This time, the global community answered back. What you are about to hear exposes a truth Israel has spent decades trying to bury, a truth that is no longer contained by press releases, lobbyists, or carefully crafted talking points, a truth that is now echoing across continents. Israel is losing the world, not because of propaganda, not because of misinformation, but because the world has finally seen the reality with its own eyes. The bombed schools, the mass graves, the starvation, the journalists killed, the children buried beneath rubble, the endless justifications for the unjustifiable. And now, at the United Nations, that truth is being spoken aloud. Not whispered, not softened, spoken. We are witnessing the beginning of the end of Israel's ability to control the narrative. The end of the era where they could silence critics with accusations. The end of the illusion that they stand above accountability. Danny Dannon walked into that chamber expecting the usual deference. Instead, he walked into a wall of global outrage, a wall built from the voices of nations that have had enough, a wall built from the testimonies of survivors, a wall built from the undeniable evidence of crimes committed in plain sight. This is not a shift. This is a rupture, a break in the story Israel has told the world for 75 years. And as you listen, remember this. History does not change in silence. It changes when the world finally says, enough. So now, together, let us listen to WLA Times as they capture this moment of reckoning, a moment where Israel is confronted, challenged, and placed exactly where it belongs in the eyes of the international community. This is Israel being called out live at the United Nations. This is humiliation not crafted by enemies, but delivered by the world itself. This is the blacklist, the backlash, the breaking point. This is the sound of a narrative collapsing. And now, together, let us listen.
You caved to the Secretary General's obsession with targeting Israel.
And I'm sorry, but so, I have to make a point of order.
No, you will be quiet because
this is what the chair
now.
Should be doing.
You spoke,
I make
now
a point of order. They
you
should
spoke,
not be personal.
Now I speak.
It
shame
should
on
not
you.
Be personal.
You're part of the bullying
I have
of
a point of order.
Shame
here.
On you.
I have
you
a point of order.
You spoke,
I
now
will
I
not
speak.
Walk out.
You walk out.
We have verified evidence.
You're part of this.
This is a point of order.
You're part of this obsession.
No personal attack.
You're part of this obsession.
No personal attack.
Excuse me, you are part of this shameful behavior.
No, I'm sorry.
A tense face-off has erupted at the United Nations. Israel's envoy, Danny Dannon, clashed openly with Vanessa Fraser, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict. Dannon accused the UN and Secretary General Antonio Guterres of targeting Israel after a separate report by Pramila Patten added the country to a list of parties suspected of patterns of conflict-related sexual violence. He demanded Pramila Patten's resignation after her report listed Israel for the first time among parties credibly suspected of responsibility for patterns of conflict-related sexual violence, accusing her of bias. You caved to the Secretary General's obsession with targeting Israel. Dannon charged. When Fraser interrupted with a point of order, insisting she had verified evidence and asking him to stop what she called personal attacks, Dannon fired back, "We are a member state and you work for the UN, and you will be quiet now. You will be quiet, you and your shameful report."
3 weeks ago, Israel was added to the Secretary General's blacklist for conflict-related sexual violence. Israel, a democracy governed by the rule of law, a country defending its citizens, placed alongside Hamas, alongside Boko Haram, alongside ISIS. Ms. Patten, you had the chance to see the facts. You had the chance to examine the evidence, but you chose not to. So again, I must ask you, why? Why did you not come to see the evidence yourself? Were you afraid the facts would not match the conclusion? This was surrender. Surrender to the Secretary General's campaign against Israel. Surrender to the rapporteurs and the so-called UN experts who bully, pressure, and smear. You caved. You caved to the pressure. You caved to the Secretary General's obsession with targeting Israel.
I'm sorry, but so, I have to make a point of order.
No, you will be quiet because
this is what the chair should be doing.
You spoke,
I make
now
a point of order. They
you
should
spoke,
not be personal.
Now I
it should not be personal.
You're part of the bullying.
I have a point of order.
Shame on you.
I have a point of order.
You spoke,
I will not walk out.
You walk out.
We have verified evidence.
You're part of this.
This is a point of order.
You're part of this obsession.
No personal attack.
You're part of this obsession.
Excuse me.
You will allow me to finish my words.
Without personal attack.
You are part of this shameful behavior.
No.
Sorry.
No personal attack.
We'll come back. We'll come back.
Let
to
him finish, and then you have the opportunity to speak. Sorry.
No.
Shame on you.
Let him finish, and then everybody will have the opportunity to speak.
You work for the UN, and you will respect the rule of the UN. Respect the rule of the UN.
Ambassador,
you will not allow you to bully us. We are a member state, and you work for the UN, and you will be quiet now. You will be quiet. Shameful.
Excuse me.
You and your shameful you, report.
I'm sorry.
We know why you took this position.
Sorry again.
We will not allow you to be
sorry
part
again.
Of this shameful campaign.
Sorry
I will
again.
Finish my words.
Ambassador,
if you don't want to listen,
Vanessa,
go out.
The United Nations has issued one of its starkest warnings yet about the toll the conflict is taking on children. In a separate annual report on children and armed conflict compiled by Fraser's office, Guterres voiced alarm over what he called a staggering rise in violations against Palestinian children. The report, released this week, also warned that Israeli settler groups could be added to a global blacklist for violations against children. Everything that follows comes from that official UN report, and the figures it says its teams verified. The numbers are staggering. The report recorded 38,558 grave violations against children worldwide in 2025, affecting more than 24,000 children. It documented 14,224 children killed or maimed, including a 34% rise in child deaths compared with the year before. Within that global picture, the United Nations said it verified the killing of 2,668 Palestinian children in Gaza and 57 more in the occupied West Bank. These are not estimates from one side of the conflict. They are figures the UN says its own monitors confirmed. The report then broke down responsibility. According to the United Nations, 9,465 grave violations were attributed to Israeli forces, and a further 326 to Israeli settlers. It is on that basis that the UN raised the prospect of adding Israeli settler groups to its blacklist of parties responsible for serious violations against children. For a close ally of the United States to appear in that section of a UN report at all is significant, and it points to how sharply the world body's assessment has shifted. A separate UN report compiled by Pramila Patton addressed conflict-related sexual violence and said investigators had verified multiple incidents involving victims from Gaza and the West Bank. It said the violence, including as a form of torture, affected 14 men, 7 women, 9 boys, and 1 girl. The report said rape and gang rape, in some cases repeated, were perpetrated against 9 victims, most from Gaza, and identified Israeli armed and security personnel among those responsible in the verified cases. These are among the most serious findings the UN has issued on the conflict. Crucially, the report did not point in only one direction. It also blacklisted Hamas's military wing and affiliated factions for killing and maiming children and for abductions, attributing 2,806 violations to Palestinian armed groups. The report named parties on both sides, listing Israeli forces while also retaining Hamas and affiliated factions for violations against children, even as the largest share of the violations attributed in the Israel-Palestine section was assigned to Israeli forces.
The Middle East is being pulled deeper into crisis, and the consequences reach far beyond the region. This week has brought wider attacks and further deterioration. I am profoundly concerned it could trigger a full resumption of conflict. Escalation in the Middle East reverberates across borders and continents. Through political tensions, displacement and rising insecurity, through markets and trade routes, through food and fuel costs, events in Lebanon. Since March, we have witnessed a serious escalation as Israel intensified its operations in Lebanese territory and Hezbollah fired deeper into Israel. We have seen the killing of civilians, entire communities uprooted, and extensive demolition of homes and civilian infrastructure in southern Lebanon. The forced displacement of over 1 million civilians, the killing of 7 UN peacekeepers, including one last week, and through it all, the risk and reality of more escalation. All parties must work towards a diplomatic settlement, a settlement that fully respects the territorial integrity, sovereignty, and political independence of Lebanon within its internationally recognized borders, in line with Security Council Resolution 1701. And I fully support a monopoly on weapons by the Lebanese government. The process must start with a comprehensive ceasefire respected by all parties everywhere, alleviating the suffering of communities on both sides of the blue line. And I urge a continued United Nations uniformed presence following the departure of UNIFIL, as proposed last week in my letter to this Council. I commend the United States for facilitating talks between Israel and Lebanon, and I hope further negotiations will contribute to lasting peace and stability. Meanwhile, I appeal to all parties to implement the ceasefire agreements. No more attacks, no more excuses. Mr. President, let me turn now to the Gulf region, where the ceasefire is more like a lesser fire, as we have seen with the escalating attacks and rhetoric over the last 48 hours. And we should not minimize the risks of a lesser fire becoming full fire, or, in another word, full war. For long periods, civilians and civilian infrastructure have come under attack in multiple countries. All threats to national sovereignty and territorial integrity are violations to international law. At the same time, restrictions on navigational rights and freedoms in and around the Strait of Hormuz are causing hardship and instability across the world, driving up energy prices and disrupting supply chains, making fertilizers more costly and anger more prevalent, pushing up inflation and piling on debt, and in fragile states, raising the risk of fresh conflict.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern. The quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine from the river to the sea. Palestine Hurra.
My national aspirations, you respect them, do you? I see. Well, the way you would respect them is by getting out of my land. That would be the best illustration of how much you respect my national aspirations. I find you fascinating, Mr. Diane. I really do. I can't understand how you have such self-assurance. A man who was born in Argentina, whose family comes from the Ukraine, and is actually wanting people, sensible people, to believe that he has some connection with my country. But there's another point I want to put to you, since you respect me so much. Tell me, to many people, you, despite your eloquence, represent nothing other, you and your fellow settlers, nothing other than common thieves. You live on stolen land, you drink stolen water, you eat stolen fruit, you farm stolen farms. Convince me, and the audience, and the viewers, that you are not, you and your settler friends, are not common thieves.